Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You're listening to the Sitting in the Park show with Bob. Today we have a very special show because I have on the phone right now Chris James, member of the group The Natural Four. Chris, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, cool. So the whole show, I guess, we'll be doing a phone interview and talking about the story of your group and playing, I guess, records that you did since you had a lot of hits. So right now, so first of all, can you give a little background? Where is your group originally from?
The group is originally from Oakland, California.
Okay. So how did you guys form, and when did your group form?
The original group formed in about 1967. Exactly was when the group actually started, was put together.
Okay. How did you guys meet?
Well, I was I just got out of service, and I was working at General Motors plant, which was in a city called Fremont, which is in California.
Okay.
And ran into some guys there that had had been singing, and they heard that I sang, and we decided to get together and see if we were a match. And actually, we were for a while, and that's actually how the group started. Actually, from this General Motors plant to records.
Okay, so how old were you about back then?
Ooh, I was about 24 years old.
Okay, so had you been singing before you formed the group?
Oh yeah, for sure. I started singing very young. That was just a part of my upbringing here in the Bay Area, which is. Our whole family sang. My mother sang. She taught us. I was studied under a gentleman by the name of James Snyder in high school. So I sang all my life. As far back as I can remember, we were always, it was part of our daily routine was to get up in the morning, and after we had kind of like a farm in Oakland, but you get up in the morning and you do your chores, and before you go to school, we was, we'd sing a couple of songs, say our prayers, and we'd be off to school. And this was every day until I was 18 years old.
Okay. So I know a lot of people had groups in high school. I don't know, like the story of a lot of Chicago groups. I don't know if you, did you sing in a group before?
Yeah, I had a group in high school. It was kind of funny because I was in a typing class.
Okay.
And me and a couple of other guys, Robert Jackson, Bobby Keys, myself, we was a three-man group, and we couldn't think of a name, so I looked at the typewriter, and we called ourselves the Underwoods, and that was the name of the typewriter, and that was the first group I was with.
Okay, but you guys never recorded anything?
Oh, no, we didn't record anything.
Okay, so, but who were the... So those people, they didn't go on to be in any other group, right?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, Robert Keys is no longer with us, and Bobby Keys is no longer with us, and Robert Jackson is a minister here in the Bay Area.
Oh, well, at least you kept in contact with them, which is...
Yeah, for the most part, I did.
So after you finished high school, you went to the service, right?
Right, but before I went to the service, I was went to junior college in the Bay Area and actually played in a band there. Played percussions in the band at Laney Junior College, and then I would say 6 months after that, I went into the service.
Okay, so when you came back, you started working at General Motors, you said?
Yes, I did. And I played the whole time I was in Germany. I was performing the whole time over there.
Okay. And so you played drums when you were over there?
No, I played. I'm a bass player, but
oh, okay.
I'm a vocalist, and I sang and I played. As a matter of fact, I was in Stuttgart, Germany, and there was a club. We played at a club called the Tivoli Bar, which is downtown in Stuttgart, and another place called 50 Meter Club. Plus, there was another club there called the Dixie Bar, and that's actually where I first ran into Tom Jones, because we were both doing club dates at the same time. This is back in the 60s.
Okay. So did you become friends with him, or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he would come see my shows. I'd go see his shows.
Okay. That's interesting. So when you actually formed the Natural Four, who were the... were people working at the plant with you. Is that right?
Actually, no. Alan Richardson, he worked as a longshoreman, and John January was a custodian at Berkeley High School in Berkeley, California. And Punkin, Al Bolton, he was a person that worked at General Motors and heard about me, and he's the one that actually approached me.
Okay, so you got together. How did you come up with the name Natural Four? Was it just because being natural was real big back then?
Yeah, actually, that's what happened, because we were all wearing naturals, and that seemed to be the trend at the time, so we just came up with the name The Natural Four.
Okay. So you formed in 67, so you just started doing, shows?
Yeah, we started working in places. There's a maiden club in San Francisco called the Dragon of Gogo, which was in the Chinese underground. And not underground, it was just downstairs to get to this place.
Okay.
And we performed there. Even while working at General Motors 6 days a week, we would leave the plant, change clothes, and go to the club. We did this for about 6 to 8 months.
Okay, so did you have like original material then that you were writing to? Or?
No, at the time we were really doing everybody else's material, Temptations, Dramatics, everybody that was out there. We were doing the Mad Lads, the Stylists. We were doing pretty much anybody that was out there.
Okay.
Material.
Do you remember some of the other groups from your area that were performing in the same places around the time?
Oh, yeah. The Ballads were, the Pace Setters. There were several other groups, the Votation. There were quite a few groups that were there at the same time that we were. But we were, at that time, we were probably the most prevalent. The Ballads were probably a bit more prevalent than us because they actually started before we did. We came in the game a little later.
Yeah. So... So what happened? How did you finally got a record contract, and your first record came out around 69, is that right?
Right, exactly. Late 68, 69 is when it came out. If I'm not mistaken, I think the first one was I Thought You Were Mine.
Okay. So what's the story? Like, how did you get hooked up with a record label, and how did the record come out?
Well, we were working with some people in Oakland. The last name was the Ivies, and they... and a guy by the name of Lou Besson, who was a professed booking agent and, you know, slash manager slash, you know, back then everybody was everything. And he actually turned us on to this gentleman by the name of Willie Hoskins, who had a small studio a couple of doors down from him downstairs called Bula Bula Records. And he turned us on to him. At first, the Ivies turned us on to Lou Besson for the bookings up in Seattle and Denver and places like that. And then one thing led to another, and we were introduced to Willie Hoskins. And that's where we first started to get into recording. The biggest problem that we had as a group, things were moving at such a rapid pace. We never really took time to write any of the material that we recorded, which was, you find out later on in life that was a mistake. But people were submitting material, and we were just singing, because we were more of a quote-unquote singing group, not a writing singing group.
Okay, so who wrote the song I Thought You Were Mine?
I'm almost willing to say that it was done by a guy by the name of Curtis Moore.
Okay. Okay, so I actually... So that song later appeared on ABC Records also, right?
Exactly, because that was the one... That one was actually the one that I think Willie took to Los Angeles to ABC, along with some other ones, Why Should We Stop, not included, and got the attention, because it was played around the barrier quite a bit.
Okay, so...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is that record, is it a different version on ABC? Because I brought it to play, but it's the ABC version. Is it the same recording?
The original was on Bula Bula Records. And it was either slow or faster. I can't really remember which one it was, but there was two different versions. They speeded it up, or they did another version of the same song.
Okay, well, I want to play your first record, but I'll play the ABC version because that's all I have now, and then we'll talk a little more. Is that okay?
Okay, fine. No problem.
Okay, cool. So this is the second version of your very first record, and this is I Thought You Were Mine.
Leaving me behind. I'm not even mine, girl.
Okay, that was just the Natural Four with an alternate version of their first record with I Thought You Were Mine. And if you're just tuning in, I have original member of the group, Chris James, here on the phone. You're there, Chris, right?
I'm right here.
And that was actually the version I played. It later came out at ABC Records. The original version you did was like a little bit slower than that. Is that
exactly. The first one, the original version was definitely slower. As a matter of fact, the same guitar player that played on that, Mr. Lloyd Gregory, is all still playing with me today.
Oh, okay, that's cool. So do you remember the other musicians that were playing on that?
I can remember maybe one, maybe two. Bruno was on bass, and Curtis Moore, I think, was on drums. I'm pretty sure he was.
So were they just like Bay Area like musicians that played on a lot
Bay
of stuff?
Bay Area guys, uh-huh. As a matter of fact, on that album by Gaylord Birch, who became the Tower Power drummer in the early days, was actually on some of that material also.
Okay. You mean, but was he was just playing, he wasn't singing, right?
No, he was just a player, but he was a phenomenal drummer.
Okay, so that record, it got some play like in the Bay Area, right?
In the Bay Area, up in Seattle, some places in Denver, like that.
Yeah, but I know.
L.A.
It definitely didn't make it to Chicago, I know.
Oh, no, it did not make it to Chicago. It made it to London.
Oh, okay.
It was big in London. Yeah, I think it still is.
At the time, or because I know in England now they're
afterwards,
collecting.
Afterwards, it's almost like underground at this point.
Yeah, I know now in England that record's really big. The fast version of the song, actually, they have something called Northern Soul.
Exactly. And that's a big thing over there.
Yeah, they have clubs and they play like these records, but they like the fast records because they play and they'd like to dance really fast to the record.
Exactly.
So. The second record that you did actually became your first really big hit, and that was called Why Should We Stop Now, right?
Exactly.
So I guess that record also came out at 69. Do you remember who wrote that record?
A guy by the name of Ricky Jones. He's since passed.
Okay. So that record it initially came out also on Bula Bula, which is
exactly, and ABC picked it up and went from there.
Okay, so what was the story behind that record? Did it get a lot of play locally and then ABC?
It got a lot of play locally. Again, it's played in Los Angeles. Got on the charts.
Okay.
Across the country.
Yeah, I looked it up and it charted nationally in May of 69 on like the Billboard R&B charts.
Exactly.
And it went to 31, so you actually had a top 40 hit.
Exactly,
with that record,
which was phenomenal.
Yeah. So, but that it charted on ABC Records. So originally, like, what was the story? Like, how did it get picked up by ABC Records?
Well, actually, our crooked producer, Mr. Willie Hoskins, made a deal. He went to Los Angeles and got a large sum of money to produce us again, to produce the album. And that's basically how it happened. There was a deal made between ABC, Otis Smith, and Willie Hoskins, and they did an album on us.
Okay.
And that was it.
Okay, so, but they released a bunch of 45s before the album came out, right?
Yeah, they did several.
So, so your cricket producer, you mean you got ripped off, you didn't get paid for anything?
Oh, we got ripped off big time, as usual, back in the day. That was part of the process. He got about $150,000, and back in 69, it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we saw, the only thing we saw was the record company had to pay was $900. he just took the money and absconded.
Oh, okay. That's not good. Yeah, that's the story of every group I interviewed.
Oh, yeah.
All got
ripped off. they were good for that.
Well, I'll play. So this actually became a big national hit, and I know in Chicago this actually didn't get that much play. I'm sure it got some play, but everyone in Chicago knows you're later. records like...
Right, which, right, because we recorded out of Chicago.
Yeah, Can This Be Real still gets played on the radio every week in Chicago, but...
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, but this record I'll play first. So this is your first big hit from 1969. This is called Why Should We Stop Now. I'm going to play it, and then we'll talk some more.
You got it.
Okay. Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. Right now, I'm doing a phone interview with Chris James, member of the group The Natural Four. Chris, you're there, right?
Yep, I'm right here.
Okay, cool. So that was just your first really big hit. That was Why Should We Stop Now? And like we were talking about, that was actually a top 40 national hit on
yes,
the R&B charts. So... I guess what happened with that song? Like, it was a big hit. Did you think you were going to be big stars once you had that big national hit? Like, what happened?
Well, of course, we all did. You know, we thought we were going to see a lot of money. None of that ever happened.
Okay. So, but did you start doing a lot more shows?
Well, yeah, we did a lot more shows. But again, all the money was taken in by people like Willie Hoskins. He just had complete autonomy over all the money. I never saw a dime from my recordings ever.
Okay. But you got paid, so you made money off of shows, is that right?
Yeah, which, you know, we finish the show, we have to come back and go back to work.
Okay. So, one thing I wanted to ask you is, Willie Hoskins, he released another record, by, like, a singer named Shirley Combs.
Right.
And I think it's got, he used the exact same backing track, and I think he even used the same backing vocals on that.
He did.
Okay. Do you remember? You don't remember that record, do you? Or do you?
I vaguely remember that record. I remember Shirley Combs too.
Okay, but you guys didn't like officially. They didn't re-record you singing behind
him. No, they didn't. He just used it, and that's how Willie Hoskins was.
Okay. Yeah, that's not.
That was a part of the business back then. Is be as crooked as you can, because ain't nobody gonna pay attention anyway.
So did you start doing some shows nationally, or what was happening? Were you still local?
Well, no. So we did some shows in L.A. Off of that particular album, we did a few shows in L.A., but basically it was around the Bay Area. You know, we didn't know that there was a bigger market that we could look at other things. We would hope to. We always wanted to go to Europe, but it never happened because nobody had any connections.
Okay. So, but that record came out in 69, and the next record you came out with was like a copy, similar sounding song,
yeah, same
right?
Same thing in mine, which didn't do well.
Okay. But it had a similar type of song. I guess I could play it if we have time, maybe near the end of the interview, probably.
Okay.
But then, so that didn't do well. And then the next record that came out was I Thought You Were Mine. And then you said that didn't, did that get some play?
I Thought You Were Mine was the very first one out there.
Yeah, but then they re-released it on ABC Records.
No,
the fast
it version. Didn't get much more play.
Okay. And then the last record they released on you on ABC was a cover of the Temptations song Message from a Black Man, right?
Right. That's the last one that they released. And what happened with that was exactly when they were supposed to be releasing my hours, there was another group, what was the name of it?
The Whatnuts.
Yeah, the Whatnuts came out with the same identical thing, and their arrangement was actually better than ours.
Okay. So, and they got play, and you
they
didn't.
They got play, we didn't.
Yeah, that, yeah.
Story of my life.
So, and ABC actually released a whole album on you guys, right?
Yes.
But you don't know what happened with the album, like it didn't get much sales?
I have no idea, because we had no control over anything. We didn't know anything. We were young. It was brand new. You know, I know that it sold enough where, as I said, Willie Hoskins left and bought him a new house in L.A. and a whole 9 yards.
Okay. So, you did get some sales, and you were one of the few soul groups to have, you know, albums on ABC, so that was at least an accomplishment, like,
yes, it was.
Like Impressions at albums. And
exactly.
Okay, cool. So, but then I guess all that ABC stuff happened like pretty much in 1 year, right? 69, like in 69?
Yeah, at the most 2 years, total of 2 years and so is the most.
So what happened? Did your contract just expire with ABC?
Willie Hoskins just absconded with all the money and just like, psh, it was gone. Nothing happened.
Okay, so, but you stopped recording for them just because your contract expired or what happened?
Right, because the contract expired, Willie Hoskins, again, I said, moved to L.A., and we were just left, you know, it was like, duh.
Okay. Okay, so what happened? But then you went and recorded one more song after ABC for his label, right?
I think it was...
It was Hanging On to a Lie.
Hanging On to a Lie, yeah.
So,
yeah. And that was when he was recording everybody else. He was recording the Ballers. He was recording...
The Pace Setters.
The Combs Girl. He was actually recording the Whispers. He'd be recording everybody at that particular time.
Okay, You, even though you knew he was like cheating you, you recorded him.
We had no recourse.
Okay, so did your lineup change around that time? Like, what was happening?
Yeah, the group changed about 1969, 1970. The group changed from Alan Richardson, John January, Al Bolton, and myself to myself. It actually changed twice. It was myself, Steve Striplin, Delmas Whitley, and Al Funkin, we call him, but it's Alfred Milton.
Al Bowden.
Anyway. It's changed, and that was that lasted about a year.
Okay. So why did the lineup change?
Well, Alan's wife was in a very bad accident.
Okay.
And John January and Alan Richardson, they didn't really want to do this as a full-time job. This was not something that it's more of a hobby for them. It became too much because we were getting ready to go on the road. And as I said, his wife was in an accident, and Johnny, it was a reason for Johnny to say, look, I don't want to do this anymore. And it was not what they wanted to do.
Okay. So, the new members of your group, you said, were,
Steve Striplin,
and
at that time, Steve Striplin and Delmas Whitley.
Okay.
Well, Steve Striplin, I actually picked him myself. I went down because we were looking because Alan and Johnny had quit. And we have some gigs coming up in Seattle, so I went down to a place called The Showcase in Oakland, California.
Okay.
And there was a contest they have every Thursday night. It's called the Bounce and Bill Contest. Went down there, saw Steve Stripling sing. He sang Summertime. I asked him, do you want to sing? He said yes. I asked, could he leave? He said yes. I picked him.
So what was it? He was in the group The Pacesetters, right?
Yeah, he is singing with the Pacesetters.
So
right.
when you went and saw him, see him sing with that group? Or
no, he was singing by himself.
So the group was already broken up at that time? Or?
Well, yeah, they had gone their separate ways.
Okay.
And then when we got back, we needed still another member. And so somebody had recommended, from the Pacesetters, had recommended this guy, Delmas Whitley.
Okay.
And that's when in came Delmas. And I can say this on the end, in came the devil.
Okay.
Because he just gotten out of prison, being a leader of a some kind of a car stealing ring. These are things I didn't find out until years later.
Okay. So, and actually, before we get into details, I never asked you, what were the different parts that each member sang?
Like Steve Stripling sang baritone, second tenor.
Okay.
Punkin was doing first and second, lousy first and second. Delmas was doing baritone, second tenor, and lead. And I was doing first tenor, second tenor, and lead.
But in all the recorded songs, like on Boola Boola and ABC, you're singing lead, right?
All except for the last one.
Okay, all except for the Message from a Black Man?
No, the one after that you mentioned.
Oh, the Hanging On to a Lie?
That was Steve.
Steve singing on that.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, I want to play that record, and then we can talk some more. So on the lineup on that last record, that Hanging On to a Lie, you're saying it's you... Steve Stripling, Delmas, and Al Bowden, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, I'll play the record. So this is the last record. This record you recorded right after you left ABC Records back on Willie Hoskins' Boola Boola label, and this came around
exactly.
In 1971, I think. So I'll play this record, and we'll talk some more. This is The Natural Four with Hanging On to a Lie. This is a really good song.
Bye.
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You're listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today is a very special show because I'm doing an interview with Chris James, who was a member of the group The Natural Four. Chris, you're there, right?
Yep, right here.
Okay, cool. So the song I just played came out in 1971, and it was called Hanging On to a Lie. And that was released on the local California Bula Bula label. And the B-side of that record, actually, it's a nice sort of ballad. It's called 12 Months of the Year. It's actually a cover of The Moonglows, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So what led you to sort of do that song?
Well, we were trying to be as diverse as we could in terms of the material that we were doing in live shows.
Okay.
So we just said, heck, we're doing it live. We may as well do it on an album.
Okay. So that was just sort of one of the songs you did, and then you just ended up recording it.
Exactly.
So that record, it didn't really go anywhere, right? Like, he didn't get much...
No, not on Hanging On to a Lie. No,
okay.
Not at all.
Did you get any play, like, in Oakland or, like, local play, you know?
Oh, locally we got play on Hanging On to a Lie, but not like I Thought You Were Mine or Why Should We Stop Now.
Okay. So, definitely it wasn't until later that you had more national hits.
Exactly.
So, actually, right after that record, you actually signed to Chess Records, right?
Yeah, for a minute.
Okay. What's the story behind that?
I met this gentleman by the name of Ron Carson, and him and Willie Hoskins did some kind of deal, and he was really the guy that was working with Chess Records, and so we signed for one particular, actually two songs, but we did sign a short contract to do a couple of songs, and that was the extent of it.
Okay. So how did you hook up with... So first of all, was Willie Hoskins still your manager at the time?
He was never our manager. He was just our crooked producer.
Okay. You didn't have a manager? You just sort of dealt with everyone?
Not really. We were just a ragtag group of guys that wanted to perform.
Okay.
So we didn't really have anybody that was really in charge of us, which that was the biggest mistake that we made.
Okay. So first of all, was your lineup still... It was still you...
Well, by this time, things had changed because during the time that we were performing, Punkin was the member at the time, and he was pretty much into the street life, which meant that he was, selling marijuana, at home to make money for us to go on the road and stuff like that. So something happened between him and Delmas Whitley.
Okay.
That caused them to go through a bunch of houses. They were all staying together except for myself. I was in my own home.
Okay.
And a big split came up behind some personal stuff that happened between the two of them. And Punkin made a choice. He said, look, man, I'm quitting. And if you want to go with me or you want to stay with them, well, at the time, a little stupid me, I'm saying the majority was better. And I ended up staying with Steve and Delmas. And then another gentleman by the name of Daryl Kennedy, who had been singing with them in the Pacesetters, he came into the group. And so we continued on. And there was a complete, about a year, year and a half of absolutely nothing happening.
Okay. Well, you had that one record on Chess right at that time, right?
Right, but that was before Daryl.
Okay,
so right after Punkin was in there. It was in that, it's kind of hard to remember exactly when, but it was doing that transition.
Okay, so what's the story behind that Chess record? Like, how did you get, but before we get on to, like, the new lineup, how did you get hooked up with, you said Ron Carson, he wrote and produced a lot of Whispers records too, right?
Exactly.
So how did
He was a friend of Willie Hoskins. They were all friends. Willie Hoskins, Lou Besson, Lou Chin, the Ivy Brothers, all these guys were friends of each other. They knew each other.
Okay.
Because the scene locally was pretty small.
Okay. So he hooked up with Chess Records, and you recorded this record called Give a Little Love, right?
Right, exactly. I recorded that one. I also recorded the Whispers' first big hit, which was I Only Meant to Wet My Feet. I recorded it before they did.
Okay.
And the story to that was they wanted to sign the Whispers up. The Whispers were hedging because they were with a guy by the name of Louis Chin, who was the Asian guy that owned the Dragon of Go-Go.
Okay.
And we were used, literally, my group was used as a, and myself specifically was used as a pawn. He said, look, he gave them a choice. You either sign with us, or we're going to put this record out on Chris James and Natural Four, and they're going to go so forth and so on, because Dick Griffey was involved, and major people were involved. It was very simple, you either sign with us, or we're going to put it out. So what they did, they took me to L.A. I recorded the song. They took me to L.A. with the whole nine yards, really had the Whispers guessing what they were going to do. And, so of course, the Whispers signed because they didn't want me to sign.
Okay.
myself and the Whispers have really never been friends, because what they did was they literally actually captured my style of singing, and they've since gone on to bigger and better things. I'm still hanging out.
Yeah, I only went to Wet My Feet. That was a pretty big hit for them, actually.
Oh, yeah, but exactly how it is sung, I have a copy of it on tape, verbatim, inflections and everything, was so close to mine that when they released it, me and the guys in the four, we swore it was ours until we realized that it wasn't. That's how much, and the Whispers, basically, and it happens a lot, the Whispers literally took over my style of performing.
Okay.
If ever there were a show between myself, the Natural Four, and the Whispers, you would always hear, not only similar, it would sound like if you turned your back, you couldn't tell which group was singing.
Yeah, but you did get one record released on Chess, though.
But that was the one you just mentioned.
So what was the story with it? It just didn't get play or distribution?
It didn't get any play. You know, it was, I mean, I found out down the line, all of it was a ploy. They got me. They wanted to get the Whispers. They put this one out on me. They didn't really promote it. Then they did, I only went to Wet My Feet, and that was the one. They knew, just like we knew, that if, in fact, that song got out there, that it was going to be a hit. And so that's in the story.
Okay. So I'm going to play, it's a pretty good song, so either way I'll play it, this Give a Little Love record, and then we'll talk some more.
You got it.
So this is the one record that Chess Records released on the Natural Four from 1971. This track is called Give a Little Love.
Let me tell you, the fairy tales come true.
Okay, that was just the Natural Four with the one record they released on Chess Records called Give a Little Love. And Chris James is here, a member of the group, talking about the records. And you were just saying that Chest really didn't promote it, and they pretty much, it was like a write-off that they used.
That's pretty much what it was. It was just a write-off.
Just so they could get a hold of the Whispers on
Janice. Exactly.
On Janice,
it was the whole plan.
So there was so after that, there was like a year or something like that, or a year and a half maybe, where you weren't doing
anything.
Much, and your lineup had changed to the final lineup, right?
The final lineup, which was myself, Daryl Kennedy, Delmas Whitley, and Steve Stripler.
Okay. So, and then you eventually got hooked up with Kurt Tom Records in Chicago, right?
Exactly.
So what's the story with that?
We were performing someplace in Oakland, showcasing sportsmen. There was a guy by the name of Wally Cox. He was actually a friend of my sister's.
Okay.
And he was working with Marvin Gaye, and he was working with Curtis. And he was one of those, you know, back in the day they had these guys that went all over the place, and they're promotion men, and he was one of them. And he mentioned to Curtis about us, because he heard us do, off of the Superfly album, he heard us do Eddie You Should Know Better with four-part harmony. He told Curtis about it. He in turn told his business partner, Marv Stewart. And Marv came from Chicago to California to hear us perform the song. We did. We performed it for him. He enjoyed it. He had us do another show in a place called Stockton, California, where it was us, Curtis Mayfield, Bill Withers, and one other group. I can't think of the name of them. And they signed us right after that.
Okay. So... And then they took you to Chicago to record?
Brought us to Chicago to record, and that's when things really started taking a different turn for us.
Okay, so, and one of the main people you worked with on at least the first Kurt Tom album, I guess most of them, was Leroy Hudson, right?
Yeah, he was the main producer for our first album.
Okay, so the first record they put out on you was called Things Will Be Better Tomorrow, right?
Right, that was the first one they put out for us. Now, that one was done by a guy by the name of Rich Tufo. He was actually the producer on that.
Okay, yeah, it definitely, that song, yeah, I can see Rich Tufo wrote it, but that song definitely sounds like Leroy Hudson type song, like a conscious kind of, you know, like politically conscious type
exactly,
song.
Exactly, Leroy was really into that.
Yeah, so, but then that song didn't really do very
didn't
well.
Didn't do well at all. To me, it was a dumb song. I didn't really like it. But I was one of those kind of voices that you could pretty much give me a song,
okay,
no matter what it was, and I'm going to be able to sing it.
Okay.
You know, there was not necessarily any enthusiasm and or a way to express it. It was just a song.
Okay. So then that song didn't do that well, and then they released your version of Eddie You Should Know Better that you were just talking about, right?
Exactly.
But that didn't get
that
much.
Didn't do well either.
Okay, but they at least they didn't give up.
No, they didn't give up.
And then you finally scored a massive hit with your song "Can This Be Real"? Right.
"Can This Be Real" was a big one for us.
So what was the story behind that record? Like it just started getting. I have it written down. Actually, it got national play. It actually hit number 10.
Right.
On the Billboard chart. So that was the biggest hit you ever had.
Exactly.
Like top 10 hit, which is pretty cool. So, like, do you remember when the song broke? Like what happened?
I can't remember the exact time that it broke.
Oh, well, I mean, I think...
But it was 72, 73.
Yeah, I think it was the end of 73. But, I mean, do you remember what was happening? Like you were excited that you had this huge hit all of a sudden?
Oh, of course we were excited. You know, we ended up doing a lot of television shows. We did Midnight Special, Soul Train, American Bandstand, In Session, the Wolfman Jack Show. We were doing every show that you could think of.
Okay. So, but you hadn't been on, like, TV shows before then, right?
No, not at all.
Okay. So, at that point, did you really think you were going to be big stars?
Oh, of course. Okay. We were right there.
Okay. So, and were you based in Chicago at the time?
For the most part, we were based out of Chicago, even though we lived in Oakland. We were based out of Chicago. Everything that we did, we'd fly to Chicago, do what we had to do, we'd leave from there and go to all the other places.
Okay, so at that point, were you doing music, like, full-time?
Yeah, for the most part, but only for certain periods of time, maybe 6 months, and then we'd be off, and then 6 months. We hadn't really geared up hardcore yet.
Okay. So, I think I'll play this record, and then... We'll talk some more. So this is your, you know, your group's biggest hit. This still gets played in Chicago every week. This is The Natural Four with "Can This Be Real?"
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. If you're just tuning in, I'm doing a special interview with Chris James of The Natural Four. That was just their biggest hit from 1973. I think it was like December 73.
Mm-hmm.
And that was called Can This Be Real? So we were just talking off the air about how that was the first record that, like all the other records before, you were actually singing lead on pretty much. And then that was the first record that Delmas Whitley became the lead on that record, right?
Exactly.
So what was the story behind that?
Well, they just felt that, well, Leroy felt that Delmas had the same similar type of voice that he had.
Okay.
And I can say categorically that was, you know, even though that was true, that was a really big mistake in the overall scheme of things.
Okay.
Because some people can't deal with success in any form properly, and Delmas didn't. He became worse than what he was when he first got in the group in terms of his mannerisms and things that he did the whole time we were on the road.
So you were mentioning that when he joined the group, he just got out of prison. He was like stealing cars.
He just got out of prison. And not prison, but like, he was like 17, 18 years old. Yeah, he was just getting out of prison.
So he was younger than you guys, too?
Oh, yeah, he was younger than me.
Okay.
And he had been the leader of some car stealing ring in the Bay Area, and I didn't know anything about this. And Willie Hoskins put him in the group, didn't tell us until, I didn't find out until about a year and a half later what was going on.
Okay. Did you confront him about it?
But by that time, it was really too late to do anything. What can you do? He's already in a group. He's already established. We need. So we let it go on. But as time progressed, I started watching behavior from Delmas, and it became even more erratic. He would do things like rob liquor stores when we was in towns, and he'd rip off girls' purses, and he would do things, unnecessary things that would always bring negative attention to the group. Him and I got into a lot of hassles about that.
But you didn't need the money at the time, right? Like you were getting paid for shows.
It wasn't about the money. This was this guy's. This is him. This is how he is.
Okay.
That's why he's in jail now. He just got 52 years for the same situation, robbing a bank. He was a career criminal.
And
okay. You have these kinds of people. We didn't know this. He was a good singer.
Okay.
He was a good showman. But the other side of him was a real dark side, and that was the dark side of him. I would say this if he was sitting here in front of me. This is the kind of person that he was.
Okay. So, yeah, that's it's too bad, but...
Yeah, it was very too, it was too bad, because... And then everybody else started seeing. I think Curtis Neal started seeing how he was, and there are some people out there that this is just their lifestyle.
But you did manage to sort of hold the group together for three whole albums, right?
I held it together until 76, you know, because this was my dream, and I didn't really want anybody to make it any worse, even though each month or each several months it became worse. He became worse. He missed gigs. We'd be at places. He wouldn't show up. He got locked up a few times. He would do all the things. It reminds you, they had the, I think it was the group that they called, it was a television, that was supposed to be like the Temptations. I forget what they called them. It was a movie about these guys.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
No, I'm not sure, actually.
Okay, there was a movie on a while back, and it was talked about the exact same thing that happened in this movie, and somebody's going to probably tell you the name of the movie. Even though there were five people in the group, I can't think of the name of this movie, but it was a big movie.
Okay.
Five Heartbeats. You remember that movie?
I think so.
It's called The Five Heartbeats?
Okay.
Okay, this movie could have depicted our group specifically, because exactly the same thing that happened. People that knew us said that movie was us.
Okay, so there was just one guy who was like a criminal.
One guy that was a clown. And the cool part about it, because him, Steve, and Daryl had worked together before, I was always at the odd man out. But I was the leader of the group to some degree. Even though I was the leader of the group, I was not the leader of the group when it came to things that were not necessarily progressive or conducive to helping the group out. Daryl was the person. He had Leroy was enthralled with him so much so that he actually recorded after, which is another part of the story, after the group broke up, he tried to record Delmas in Chicago. And I don't even think Leroy knew this, but Delmas had come to the Bay Area and had pulled another robbery, took the money back to Chicago and tried to get recorded.
so
this is the kind of guy that he was.
So how come since he was causing all these problems you couldn't
replace him?
Yeah.
Number one, we were on the road, and I try on several occasions to replace Delmas, and either the people that I tried to replace him with, the schedules wouldn't work out. I tried several one guy by the name of Daryl Grant. There was a couple of twins that I tried to replace him with, and for some reason or another, things just didn't work out, and we just kept on going. And during the time that I was trying to replace him, of course, I was having a lot of static from Daryl and from Steve. And so it was really an uphill battle, and we couldn't stop rehearsing and keeping things together, because Curtin was making things happen for us, like, as I said, this, you know, Midnight Special, Soul Train, American Bandstand, the Apollo. We did the Apollo two times, and I guess after a certain period of time, I just got tired of trying to find somebody that was going to be able to fit and have to deal with the other guys, and we kept on going until the end.
Okay, so let's talk about your records a little bit more, and then I'll play a record and we can talk a little bit more. So after Can This Be Real came out, you had a record called Love That Really Counts,
right?
Which definitely got played, actually charted also, but that was kind of like a copy record of Can This Be Real.
It had
a very similar sound. And then the next record that came out was another pretty good record. It did better. Still off your first album, it was called You Bring Out the Best in Me.
Right, and I don't ever know to this day how come that record did so well. It was not one of my favorites.
Okay, but it definitely, you could tell in Chicago, it definitely had a Chicago type of sound.
Yeah, it did have a Chicago style.
So actually, and what was your opinion about like the sound of the group changing once with the different producers at Curtin? Like, you became a Chicago-sounding group at that time.
Well, I feel that we were actually a Chicago-sounding group with a California feel because of the harmonies and the way that we actually sang the songs.
Okay.
Because our roots were still California roots, even though the producers were like, Leroy Hudson, Larrell Simon, and cats like that. They were still California vocals, California. We were still different, and that's what I think they saw in us.
Okay. Yeah, but definitely Leroy, and they definitely infused that kind of sound into your records.
Exactly. Musical sound, but they didn't change the harmony.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I'll play your record, You Bring Out the Best in Me, which is probably, in Chicago, the record that people would know Beth next to Can This Be Real?
I think so.
And then we'll talk some more. So this is The Natural Four with You Bring Out the Best in Me. Okay, that was just The Natural Four with probably their second biggest hit in Chicago. That was You Bring Out the Best in Me, real Chicago type of sound from that era.
Really, man, the thing I liked about that song, though, if nothing else, even though I didn't like my own performance, the arrangements on that were great.
Okay, yeah, that definitely sounds...
That was big, that was huge.
And that I think that came around like the summer of 74, around that
right,
time.
Right, that was like Hollywood arrangements.
Yeah, it was like from a movie or something.
Oh, yeah, man, yeah. Big, huge.
So, and one thing I meant to ask you was, one of my favorite songs from your first album, all those records actually was from your first album, so that was like a really big album, had a lot of hits on it, and the whole album is pretty excellent all the way through, but one of my favorite songs is, it's a B-side, it's called Love Society.
Yeah, Love Society.
You told me...
The original title of that song, it was written by Lucky Scott.
Okay.
And the original title of that song was called We're All Gonna Die. And I said, there's no way am I gonna get on and put this on no record talking about We're All Gonna Die. So we changed it from We're All Gonna Die to Love Society, changed the lyrics right on the spot.
It definitely is a real nice song, though, so it came out well.
Yeah, it was a good song. I mean, Lucky was a great writer. He was a good person. I really liked Lucky a whole lot. Too bad he's not here with us anymore. He was a great bass player.
Okay. And you were telling me he played with Curtis and stuff.
Oh, yeah. He did all the Superfly stuff. That was him. He was right there.
Okay. So after that was all of your first album on Kurt Tom.
Right.
And you had two other albums, right? And at the time you were doing a lot of shows, is that right? Like both TV shows?
A lot of shows, yeah. Like I said, we did Chicago Amphitheater, we did Clinton Jen's Place, we did a place called Mr. Kelly's, and you know, I gotta speak about that. This is the first time in my life that we'd been in Chicago. We was staying at a place called the 2 East Oak Building. It was downtown Chicago. And so they booked us into Mr. Kelly's.
Okay.
And that was the first time that I've ever come face to face with real racism in my life, musically.
Okay.
We would go in the front door like we did in California, and they wouldn't allow that. Now, this is in the 70s.
Yeah, that's crazy, because usually you hear about that stuff in the 60s, but that is happening
in the
70s.
This is in the 70s. It was, I mean, they weren't blatant to that point, but the employees were really ugly. And because we walked into the front door, they called to Chicago called to Marv Stewart and said, hey, look, can they, whatever expletives they use, they just walked in the front door and blah, blah, so forth and so on. Because people like Don Carnese would hang out there. And so it was not that they didn't accept other ethnic people in there. It was that as a group, we were supposed to be going in the back door, and this guy, I'll never forget it, because Sandy Barron was there. He was a comedian at the time, and I actually called him up on the stage and got a chance to spoof him and stuff. But it was very strange just the way that people treated us in that particular club, which is no longer there, I heard.
Oh, yeah. None of the clubs are really there anymore, but you were saying that club was actually on the north side of Chicago.
It was the north side of Chicago.
But was there,
I mean, you know, the richest section of Chicago.
So was there like a white audience for your show mainly?
Oh, yeah, it was a white audience. But, okay. You know, they knew material, and, you know, nothing. It was a supper club.
Okay.
So we're doing more like a supper club set.
Yeah, definitely. None of the groups I talked to talked about playing at that club. None of the groups I talked to on my show talked about playing at that club, maybe because they had bad experiences there. I don't know.
Well, it was good because we got to perform there, and it was a major club. Mr. Kelly's was a big club. It was not big in terms of the size. It was big because of who ran it. And again, maybe that was a reason.
Okay, so. Yeah, but at the time you definitely had hits, and your next hit was called Heaven Right Here on Earth.
Heaven Right Here on Earth, uh-huh.
And it charted. I have written down it charted on Billboard, but none of the remaining songs you had ever hit top 40.
I know.
Okay, but it was a good song, and the whole album is pretty good all the way through. So I'll play this record, Heaven Right Here on Earth, and we can talk a little bit more.
You got it.
Okay, so this is, again, the title cut of the second Kurt Tom record by The Natural Four, Heaven Right Here on Earth.
People say
Okay, we're back here live doing an interview with Chris James of The Natural Four. That was just the title cut off of their second Kurtom album called Heaven Right Here on Earth. Still like a nice, you still continued to have, like it was a minor hit and you had a nice sound still on that record.
Oh yeah, it was still happening.
So by that point, you were having like more and more problems with demos.
Oh, his problems became almost insurmountable in a lot of ways. We would play in a place called the 20 Grand in Detroit.
Okay.
And he got caught up with somebody's wife, and the guy was just going to take him out. For some reason, people saw something happen and called the police, and they looked out. And they were able to walk out, Steve Stripling and Delmas both. But then we heard that they were going to come after Delmas, at the club. And the worst thing about that was that we would switch positions when we were doing choreography. Luckily, it didn't happen. They caught the guy before he got in. And the next couple of days, we were out of town. And that was the end of it. But it was just things like this. And him missing. We was in Chicago, Atlanta.
So you're saying you almost got shot because of him, because you were switching
positions. Yeah, exactly. We were in Atlanta at a place called Scarlett O'Hara's, which is Atlanta Underground.
Okay.
And it was just myself, Steve, and Daryl. And Delmas again showed up late. And when he showed up, he showed up drunk.
Okay.
Falling down on the stage in front of a packed house. It was us. It was the Impressions. It was Curtis Mayfield. I forget who else was there. Maybe Linda Kletter, because we were all in it. And he comes in and, again, makes us look like clowns because he's doing all the things that he's not supposed to do, being drunk, falling down the stage, being late. He was a problem, always. It was like, you know, he could care less. He felt that he was a star behind Can This Be Real? And he was the reason that the group broke up, literally, because I personally couldn't take it anymore. And Curtis and him were not doing anything. So I said, look, either you guys get rid of Delmas or I'm out. And I actually ended up in the hospital after that.
Okay.
Just physically went to the hospital.
Okay. So the group broke up. You just because you said, you know, we can't deal with Delmas.
Yeah, I said, but either they change him and they didn't want to change him, or I'm out and I quit.
Okay, so but he was actually singing lead on most of the songs by then. Is that right?
Not on most of them. On about a third of them. I still was maintaining that it had nothing to do with, you know, like on the last album, the Night Chaser album. I was still maintaining a certain amount. I was still doing at least 40%, not quite 50, but 40%.
Okay.
Of the lead. So I was still in charge. But to deal with him personally was just, you couldn't deal with him. If he had a glass of beer, he became crazy. He was just not a nice person.
Okay. So I guess, you pretty much just broke up the group then? Cause
they tried to go on without me. This was after the last album, which was the Night Chaser album, which you don't have a copy of. They tried to go on without me, and I said, fine, if you guys can do it without me, you do it. So they went and got another guy and tried it for about 6 months, and, you know, Delmas apparently kept on with his antics, and it never happened.
Okay.
They didn't leave Oakland. It was it.
So, but you let them take the name, or you didn't try to?
Oh, no. They don't have the name. I own it.
Okay. So they and you were saying that Delmas tried to come back, like, record with Leroy Hudson later?
Yeah, he went back to Chicago after he had done a robbery here in the Bay Area, and took the money and went back to Chicago. And again, this is hearsay that I heard through a pretty reliable source. And they got to Chicago and hooked up with Leroy and tried to do some more recording, which didn't do anything.
Okay. But yeah, I guess in that last period of the group, you still managed to have a few. First of all, who was singing lead on the Heaven Right Here on Earth?
I was.
Okay. And then you had another hit off of that album called Love So Wonderful.
That was Delmas.
Okay, Delmas singing it. And then your last two records, I think, were off of your last album, which I don't have here. One's called It's the Music.
That was on the first one.
Oh, okay, that's off the first album?
That's off the first album.
Oh, okay, I have that here. I guess I can play that if we have time. And then the last record you ever released, it was a song called Free.
Yes, exactly. And that was on the last album. That was with Chuck Jackson, Marvin Yancey were our producers.
Again, they were here in the writers' workshop here in Chicago. That were
right, they were at Kurt Time because it was us, Linda Clifford, Natalie Cole. It was a bunch of us all together at that particular time.
Okay, so around 1976, I guess the group broke up.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them tried to go on with a new name, but they failed. You don't remember what the new name was or anything, do you?
No, they didn't even try to change the name. I let them use Natural 4.
Okay, but then
so
they...
you guys can use it. I mean, I had no problem with it. If they could make it, fine.
Okay, so...
I already knew that they were not going to make it.
Okay, but Kurt Time Records kind of disbanded around that time,
oh, yeah,
too. So.
Yeah. They disbanded, and the company started going down because a lot of things were happening within the company. I don't know their particulars, but after we left, it seemed like things just went downhill.
Okay, and but you still wanted to be involved with music, right? Like when you left.
Oh, I still am. I've never gotten out of it.
So what did you do right after the group broke up? Did you try to continue recording or form another group?
Oh, I actually, as I said, I went in the hospital. I was in the hospital I was down for about 6 months, and then I went to work and then started performing with my sons.
Okay.
And we started just doing local gigs around the Bay Area. Then we moved to Los Angeles, and I got my sons into television and commercials, doing TV shows and doing commercials. Stayed down in L.A. for 7 years, and that's pretty much what I did.
So through the early 80s, that's what you were doing pretty
much?
Yeah,
the 70s and 80s. And I had to get a job because the music was from 76 until about... By 78, not a whole lot was happening. We're doing shows here and doing shows there, just small shows with myself and my sons.
Okay.
And then, as I said, we moved to Los Angeles and got them into commercials and television work.
Okay.
And still played music always.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, we did a television show because we wrote a song called Father and Son.
So you and your sons, right?
Me and my sons.
Okay.
We call ourselves, at the time, we were the first group to call, before Prince, we were the first group to call themselves Family.
Okay.
We did a show back then, it was a Leslie Uggams and Peter Marshall show, it was called Fantasy.
Okay.
And they featured our song on there because it was a Father's Day show. And we actually did a TV show and got a chance to sing on television. We also performed for the Black Filmmakers Association, myself and my sons also.
Okay, when was that?
Oh, man, I would say that was like 83, 84, like that.
Okay, and so afterwards you continued to be involved with music?
Always been involved with music, and then there's always a low part in there. There was always a low part in there. And then I met Johnny Hooker in the early 60s.
Okay.
And I ended up meeting his daughter in 85.
Okay.
And I was recording my sons. And I met her at a place called La Martinique. And we got to talking, and she told me who her father was. And I said, I know your dad, and so forth and so on. And her and I formed a business relationship. And we started recording. And she was sitting out there, and I heard her singing background that my sons were singing, and asked her to sing. And I've been her producer for the last 18 years.
Okay, so first of all, have your sons released material at all?
The only thing that I released on my son was a song called The Father and Son Song. Nothing. It was on Ayla Records, which was, what was his name? Oh, the comedian, real famous brother. Richard Pryor was his label.
Oh, okay. So when did that? I never heard of that record. When did
I know.
Out?
It was out in about 83.
So you're singing on the record with...
I'm singing with my sons on the record. It's a beautiful song. I'll send it to you.
What's the title of it? What's the title of the group? What it's released as the
group? The name of the group was called Family.
Okay.
And it's, we only released that one song.
Okay, and it's you singing with
my sons, and it's called Father and Son.
Okay. And then you released, or you recorded material with... what's the name of John Lee Hooker's daughter?
Zakiya, Z-A-K-I-Y-A, Zakiya Hooker.
Okay. And so you've been working with her... up till now, is that right?
Oh, since 1990, I started working with Zakiya.
Okay.
And produced two albums on her. One was called Another Generation of the Blues. The other one was called Flavors of the Blues, which you can pick up either one of them. And then I just finished doing a posthumous album on John Lee called Face to Face.
I have to let in the next DJ. So I'm going to play a record on you, and then we can talk a little bit more. Is that okay?
You got it.
Okay, so this next record I'm going to play... it came out after Heaven Right Here on Earth. This track is called Love So Wonderful, and then we'll talk more.
You got it.
Okay. Okay, we're back here live talking to Chris James, member of the Natural Four. That was just a track called Love So Wonderful, which came out, I think it's summer of 75. It was the second record you released off of your second Kurt Tom album, right before your last album.
Right.
So we were just talking about what you're doing, what you've been doing. You're talking about how you've been producing music on Zakiya, who is now your wife, right?
Who is now my wife, yes.
And you said she has two albums out?
Two albums. One was called Flavors of the Blues. I mean, Another Generation of the Blues.
Okay.
And then that was on a British label.
Okay.
And the other one was called Another Generation of the Blues is the first one, and the other one is the Flavors of the Blues, which was on Warner Brothers.
Okay.
I mean, Virgin Records.
Okay. So she thinks she's doing like blues vocals.
Yeah, but she's not a blues, quote unquote, blues singer like Coco Taylor or nothing like that. Hers is more contemporary blues, more ballady bluesy.
Okay. And but recently you started to perform again yourself, is that right?
Yes, I did. I just finished a show in Thailand for the Second World Music and Blues Festival in Thailand.
Okay, that's crazy. How did that happen, and how did you get to perform in Thailand?
Got a friend of ours had been telling us we need to go visit Thailand. We got on a plane, myself, my wife, my partner Tony Cook, and my drummer Marlon Green. We got on a plane. Went over there, we set something up, they said, look, we want you guys come, we can't pay you this trip, but if you come and play, we'll see what we can do, and they set some stuff up, and we went to the first one that they had. We did a week at this club called Coco's Blues Club in an island called Kazamoy in Thailand, and they actually go on, anybody goes online and goes CocoBlues.com, you're going to be able to see some of the people perform there. We had, on this particular show, which my company, which is Boogie with the Hook, is the name of my company. We brought over Jerry Lee Lewis, Ike Turner, and then there were three groups like Big Brother and the Holding Company, Canned Heat. These are older groups.
Yeah.
And a couple of old blues players, Zakiya Hooker, and myself, Chris James. We brought over the American side of the performers. They had UB40 and the Wailers on the show.
Okay.
And a lot of Thai performers.
So you were saying the audience at that club, it's more like European tourists.
More European clientele that come there. They're, you know, this it's a luxury island.
Okay.
In the coast of Bangkok.
So
and that's where they go to, you know, for the winter months. They go to, you know, kind of chill out and enjoy themselves.
So you're performing now as the Natural Four. How are you?
No, I'm performing as Chris James. And or A.K.A. Owen Christopher of Natural Four.
Okay, and who did you get other people to sing with you, or just you hired?
Oh, I just hired some vocalists. I hired, as a matter of fact, I had two ladies and a gentleman.
Okay, so but definitely you're interested in performing more and doing more shows, right?
Yeah, I'd like to do more shows, especially in Chicago. Just to be able to do some of the material that we recorded there would be a wonderful thing if we could find somebody that can hook it up.
Yeah, I wish there were more shows in Chicago. There aren't even, like, sometimes the big like oldies kind of dusty shows come where they have like stylistic stuff like that.
Right, exactly.
So yeah, but
I'd like to be on some of those shows.
Yeah, it definitely be
possible.
Good. Yeah, if you could get hooked up with that circuit, and I know they have like oldie shows in LA, and I know in England too. Like you had a couple. You're very popular in England because of like I was saying, the Northern Soul
right,
records
exactly.
Of yours. So, and I know they have performers come and play at the events that they have.
Uh-huh.
So definitely. I mean, I'll try to let anybody know that you guys are, you know, available and still performing.
I appreciate it.
So, yeah. So, again, I have to say thanks so much for doing the interview and telling your story. It's definitely an interesting story. And, also, are you recording any new material?
Yes, we are. We're recording an album on Zakiya and also an album on myself. Hopefully, it'll be out the first part of the year.
Okay. So, the album on yourself, what type of material is it?
Pretty much... not the same as back in the day, more modern, but more like a Marvin Gaye, Teddy Pendergrass, like that.
Okay. Okay, so, I'll definitely, we'll be looking out for I'll be looking out for that stuff.
Make sure you get a copy.
And the audience, you guys should be looking out for that type of stuff, too.
Right on.
And so I guess I have a few minutes left. So, again, thanks so much for doing the interview.
No, thank you so much, man, for having me on.
And I have time to play one more song. The record I'm going to play is the follow-up you did to... it's the follow-up you did to Why Should We Stop Now. This is the same thing in my mind, which is a similar sounding song. So thanks again, and folk programming is up next, so you should keep tuned.